supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A judge in Philadelphia today dropped all the criminal charges against Brandon Boston, the engineer who operated Amtrak Train 188, which derailed 2 years ago, leaving 8 dead and 200 injured. The judge said the incident sounded more likely to be an honest mistake rather than a criminal act. WHYY's Bobby Allen was at the hearing today and joins me now live in the studio. And Bobby, is it surprising that the engineer was able to beat these serious charges like involuntary manslaughter and reckless endangerment even before going to trial?
Well, Dave, surprising, I guess it really depends on who you're talking to. Definitely not to the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, which took a look at all of the evidence and said back in May there's just not enough there to convict him. They essentially said Brandon Boston did make a grave error, but he didn't act recklessly enough to be charged with a crime. But then the Pennsylvania Attorney General's Office stepped in and said, wait a minute, we think going double the speed limit, derailing a train, and killing 8 people is a crime, and we're going to try to prove it. So they went to court today and fought to put the case in front of a jury. Some family members of crash victims also wanted to see Boston stand trial, but the judge today said the evidence is too skimpy for it to go forward.
And indeed, he stopped it before a jury could even consider the case. Bobby, why do you think the judge found so little evidence to be of a nature that was compelling to see it go forward?
So in order to convict Boston, the prosecutors would have to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt, right? That's the burden of proof, that he sped into the Frankfurt Junction curve. When he sped into the Frankfurt Junction curve, he knew what he was doing. In other words, that he was actively ignoring the risk of his actions. That's what's required under Pennsylvania law to win a criminal recklessness conviction. But right before the derailment, he was hearing reports fly across his Amtrak radio that a nearby SEPTA train was getting pelted with rocks. It was like an emergency situation. And that kind of put him out of sorts. Some 5 miles later, he had 2 sharp turns to make, then a straightaway. Well, he made the first curve and then accelerated as if he was on the straightaway, when really he had another turn to make. His speeding up sent 7 passenger cars careening off the tracks. Boston's lawyer, Brian McMonagle, said, yes, he was going too fast and maybe he lost his bearings momentarily, but that's not a crime. It's a human error. That's what McMonagle thinks, at least. Here's McMonagle after the judge tossed the charges today.
These charges should have never been brought. This was never a crime. This was an accident. And as sad and as angry as we are when accidents happen, it was an accident.
Nonetheless, describe the testimony before the judge threw the case out.
Yeah, Dave. So there were some really unsettling and graphic accounts of the derailment, which again happened on May 12th, 2015. One survivor, Blair Berman, took the stand and said she was in Philadelphia for Mother's Day, and she boarded 30th Street on her way to New York City. She put her headphones in, and not long after, she thought the train was going too fast. That kind of jolted her. Then she heard loud screaming. Then she remembers being unconscious. She awoke covered in blood in the middle of the woods. She said that she was in the first of 7 passenger cars that ended up tumbling off the tracks during the derailment. And this is really strange. When she awoke, she was surrounded by trees and she was close to engineer Brandon Boston. She actually asked him if she could use her cell phone to call her dad. That was definitely an odd scene to hear. And she didn't know at the time who Brandon was, so she didn't make the connection. But anyway, throughout the day today in court, Boston remained really stoic. He wore this gray suit. He looked really stone-faced as this young woman was detailing this terrifying episode.
Going forward, does this mean Boston will never be charged with crimes for controlling the train that killed 8?
It's very likely what it means. Amtrak officials testified that he had no blemishes on his record before this. He had completed this very route some 25 times before the derailment. They also noted he wasn't under any influence of drugs at the time of the crash, nor was he distracted by his cell phone. Since the derailment, Amtrak has paid out $265 million in civil claims to victims who were in one of the cars that derailed. And they've installed this automating speeding control technology along the Northeast Corridor, which if it existed 2 years ago, it might very well have prevented this incident. Anyway, despite all of this, some are still pretty angry. Bastian won't be going to trial. Among them, personal injury lawyer Tom Klein. He's representing the family of some of the crash victims in civil litigation. Here's Tom Klein after today's hearing.
Folks who lost precious loved ones, the people who suffer from quadriplegia to catastrophic injuries for the rest of their lives, and there's absolutely no individual accountability, and that's where the victims believe there is a lack of juncture between the law and reality.
Bobby, thanks for this reporting. I will certainly check back with you if there are any new developments on the Amtrak front.
You bet. Thank you, Dave.
In other news this evening, residents in Philadelphia's Kensington section say conditions have worsened since the city and Conrail began sealing off a site by the railroad tracks popular with heroin users. At a meeting last night, they challenged city officials to do more to address the ripple effects. And for WHYY, Joel Wolfram reports.
Kensington residents told city officials they're fed up with a litany of nuisances connected to heroin dealing and using in their neighborhood. They complained about robbery, used needles getting stuck in flower pots, feces in the street, and getting hassled by dealers.
Another guy walking around with a lug wrench, swinging it, banging on cars and poles. What do we do?
I can't sit in front of my house. We can't do none of that. The junkies are the ones that are using these streets for whatever they need.
Something has to be done. We need more protection.
They say the problems have only gotten worse now that drug users can't go to the more secluded areas next to the Conrail tracks and are now moving further into the neighborhood. Captain Daniel O'Connor from the local police district assured them officers and outreach workers are going to these new hotspots.
We're trying to find that balance between enforcement and treatment.
Even the residents who spoke up weren't sure how to strike that balance. Some wanted the drug users locked up. Rick Alvarez called for a more compassionate approach.
For me, and I know the police are doing a great job in trying to maintain that balance, but listen. These people, I understand, but you know what they need? Maybe the system needs to be changed a little bit so they can get the help quicker.
Officials promised to continue efforts to get help and housing for drug users. The city says 225 people have been referred to treatment so far. They also urged residents to call 911 to report dangerous or illegal activity and to contact homeless outreach hotlines when they see people living on the street. For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
Young people from 12 to 17 in Wilmington, Delaware are far more likely to fall victim to a shooting than same-age kids in any other city. That's according to an Associated Press and USA Today Network analysis of gun violence archive data covering a 3.5-year period through June of this year. Wilmington News Journal reporter Brittany Horn has been investigating this for more than a year and joins me with a closer look. Brittany, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having us.
What specifically is accounting for this proliferation of gang activity over the past couple of years?
So people struggle to give us one solid answer. Part of it is the access to guns. We're seeing a lot more straw purchasing happening. A lot of these children had access and were able to get their hands on really strong, powerful weapons that they used to perpetuate a lot of crimes in the city. We're also just seeing a lack of respect for each other. And a lot of these kids develop a persona online that they feel like they have to back up on the street as well.
Why specifically Wilmington? Why is it so much ahead of other top 10 cities?
A lot of it seems to be the fact that we have a small city. So the data that we looked at was analyzed at a per capita rate, and Wilmington is relatively small in terms of city sizes. However, we have a lot of people bound into a really small area. And so a lot of this violence is among people that seem to know each other.
Familiarity breeds contempt.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's kind of what we started to see. I mean, you can talk to people in the city who have lost 50, 60, 70 people. We spoke with one man who said he stopped counting after a while because it was too depressing to understand how many people he had lost in the city and knew that had become victims of gun violence.
Is this typically teen-on-teen shootings?
A lot of it is. The rivalry that we looked at, we had kids as young as about 15 and as old as about 22 years old. In 2015, we had 20 juveniles shot, and last year we had 30. And those numbers are far higher than we had seen in previous years. So a lot of it is perpetrated back and forth between kids, as a large indictment showed us, specifically between two gangs, the Only My Brothers and Shoot to Kill gangs, which is the two gangs that seem to be driving the rivalry in Wilmington.
To what extent are those groups being monitored, and is part of the issue a better need to rein them in?
Last summer, at the very beginning of last summer, the Attorney General had an indictment of about 29 kids. 28 were charged at the beginning of June, and then an additional child was wrapped into this. And they were linked to about one-third of all of the shootings in the first 7 months of 2015. The CDC came into Wilmington after Hanifa Shabazz, who is now the Wilmington City Council president, called for them to come into Wilmington and analyze gun violence as a public health epidemic, which is a big difference in terms of what the CDC typically does. And they issued a report back in 2015 that gave Wilmington a prescription on how to deal with gun violence. And they said that the state should compile essentially a report card or a score for children to recognize who was in need of the most help and why, and use that data to offer them services, resources, etc. Unfortunately, that plan, or at least the crux of that plan, which is the data component, has not been implemented in the city, which is what part of our series aimed to look at, was that government officials say they haven't allocated any money and are still trying to figure out where money is best spent in Wilmington before implementing this plan.
Brittany, in the context of you investigating on the ground over the past year, is there a particular person or incident that comes to mind that's illuminating either in terms of the problem or its potential solution?
We had an interview with a number of teenagers who we ended up not identifying in the series, particularly because it can be very dangerous in Wilmington to speak out. And one of the kids was 17 years old and described what it was like growing up in Wilmington. And at one point he just finally turned and said, you know, I have to get out of here. It's not as easy as it looks growing up in this city. And I believe for me it was really illuminating to hear kids talking about the fact that they really do walk 20 or 30 minutes out of the way just to get to basketball practice because they don't feel safe in their neighborhoods. One of our first quotes actually in our first day story was a young man, the same young man, asking, you know, every day you wake up and you wonder if you're going to be shot today. You wonder if you're going to get robbed. You wonder if you're going to go home and see your mom at the end of the day. And here is someone who lost his best friend to gun violence. He lost his brother to gun violence. And it's reality. There are people that very much believe this is normal, that this is how kids across the country grow up. And as our statistics show, it's not. Wilmington is far and away the leader in places that are most dangerous for children in America.
Well, to the extent that at least becoming aware of the issue is part of the solution, thank you so much for bringing this issue to light to our listeners.
Thank you for having us.
Wilmington News Journal reporter Brittany Horn. Hundreds of health providers attended a conference on suicide prevention in New Jersey today. It's a gathering organizers say would never have happened 20 years ago. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Ann Hoffman reports.
A few decades ago, the stigma around suicide was still too great for even some health providers to talk openly about it. But this year, 300 of them gathered in New Jersey to learn about a model called Zero Suicide. It's an evidence-based approach that has significantly reduced the rates of deaths by suicide in other states. Maria Kirchner co-chairs New Jersey's Suicide Prevention Committee. She says the model encourages doctors and providers to do more screening.
Even if a person comes with a broken leg or pain, that they still perform universal screening and ask people the important question, are you suicidal?
The model is also focused on eliminating the long wait times that can keep people from getting the care they need. That's something Rutgers student Talia Bossett has experienced. She says five of her friends have struggled with thoughts of suicide, and one was told he'd have to wait 3 weeks for an appointment with a counselor.
And for a person, you know, who's suicidal, that's way too long.
Jerry Reed, an expert on zero suicide, says two providers in New Jersey have committed to the model, AtlantiCare and Rutgers.
And I think we just have to kind of challenge the status quo and challenge our comfort zone and realize that suicide care is no different than diabetes care or heart care or other types of health care.
In 2015, 789 people died by suicide in New Jersey. The state wants to lower that rate by 20% by 2025. Ann Hoffman, WHYY News.
A month-long experiment in public memorials begins this week in Philadelphia. The Monument Lab will present 25 artists in 10 city parks, trying out new ways to create monuments. For the next 3 months, members of the public are invited to respond with their own ideas. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports that the project, years in the making, has become more urgent because of events this summer in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Most of the 10 parks being used by Mural Arts Philadelphia for its Monument Lab project are clustered in Center City and its surrounding neighborhoods, but one is way up in Germantown. Vernon Park has a statue commemorating the Battle of Germantown. That was a Revolutionary War skirmish that we, meaning the American rebels, lost.
I do appreciate that it's a monument to something that's failed. Like, we need more things to be honored that have been failures, because failures often lead to, like, beautiful things.
That is Karen Olivier. She's one of the 25 artists in Monument Lab, and she lives in this neighborhood. Walks past this statue all the time. It's been here for more than a century. She made it disappear. She built a box around it made of mirrors, which performs a kind of magic trick. The mirrors reflect the trees surrounding the statue, so it seems to just vanish in a forest.
I had a feeling the reflection of the trees would make that happen. I didn't know how intensely. I mean, I was walking towards it this morning and I literally said, where is it? And I've been working on the site for days now.
For Olivier, monuments are problematic. They are permanent fixtures in the landscape erected by people who, more often than not, are no longer with us. They often outlive the driving forces that caused them to be made. By obscuring this statue under a box of mirrors for 3 months, Olivier hopes to spark people's curiosity and maybe think about why the statue is there in the first place. That's one of the central points of Monument Lab, a project spearheaded by historian Paul Farber, who teaches at Haverford College. He says monuments are not really about the person carved in stone.
Monuments are always products of their time. They're always reflections of power. You know, to know that many of the Confederate monuments went up during the rise of Jim Crow or even the Civil Rights Movement is a reminder of that.
Farber and his colleagues at Mural Arts Philadelphia have been planning Monument Lab for years, lining up a roster of artists and locations to experiment with different ways of commemorating. Some use sound, discarded row home stoops, trash, light, even a mobile phone app. What Farber did not anticipate was a neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville around a Confederate War memorial. It ramped up emotion nationally surrounding public monuments.
We're near a wound in our culture, right? What we have tried to listen to from the beginning of this project was that that pain already existed. And the coping mechanisms, the survival, the creativity that brings people to stand next to monuments to make their voice heard is also on our mind.
In a way, the deadly rally in Charlottesville scooped the Monument Lab by forcing a conversation about the problem of memorials in August. It's a conversation historians have been having for years, and now it's public. Seth Brueggemann is a history professor at Temple University. He says monuments often go up at a moment when the city or the nation is grappling with a very difficult situation. And he says monuments are a way of passing the buck.
Sometimes we need to pass the buck, right? Think about the aftermath of 9/11. Our country did not have the capacity, I don't think, to have a critical conversation about what that event really meant. And the days right after, how do we deal with that? We build a monument, right? We find a way to seek catharsis through the construction and reconstruction of our memory. And that's okay. The problem is, once we finish the monument and walk away, we forget that that monument represents an unresolved conversation.
Brueggemann is standing in Philadelphia's Independence Mall, and he says here, the history of America's evolving attitudes toward monument making is on display. There's some kind of commemoration in every direction you look. But the reasons those monuments were made is nowhere to be seen.
A monument is always concluding punctuation to the sentence. When you see a monument, you're seeing the end of the sentence, but you never get to know what the sentence was.
A big component of Monument Lab is asking for public feedback. At each site, people will be able to contribute their own ideas about what would be an appropriate monument to the city of Philadelphia. Those suggestions will be put into a database. None of those suggestions will be actually built. That's not the point. Monument Lab's most permanent contribution to the city's landscape will be a data set of unfiltered ideas gleaned from residents about what they say is worthwhile remembering in Philadelphia right now. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
The Philadelphia theater troupe called Tribe of Fools mixes original scripts with dancing and fight scenes. It's often had a dark horse hit at the Philadelphia Fringe Festival. The troupe's latest fringe offering, called Fishtown, is also the opener of the Tribe of Fools season. WHYY theater critic Howard Shapiro offers this review.
We've given our credit cards to online sites, and Equifax has stored our social security numbers. Well, you know where that's led. In the new show Fishtown, Tribe of Fools goes a step further. Their goofy, funny production is about an internet company headquartered in Fishtown, where the aim is to steal our memories. They're using our profiles to enter our brains, and by never reading the fine print to anything nowadays before we hit accept, we've signed our rights away. Tribe of Fools is an especially local stage company with material that highlights Philadelphia foibles, high-energy movement, and fight scenes. The company has at least twice had Philly Fringe dark horse hits. This spoof of internet piracy at the current Fringe has all the signs of becoming another one. It's the sort of show that gets a buzz among younger audiences, a big part of Tribe of Fools fans, because it bulges with hip references to local lifestyle and technology. That's music from the show. Sound designer Damian Figueres set the tone for the show's film noir style. In fact, it's about two investigators who try to expose the internet company's evil project. The dialogue, popping with metaphors and similes, comes at you so quickly that some of it gets lost. But don't get frustrated. There's more to catch a few seconds later. And there's Tribe of Fools' usual industrial strength movement, and one dance that's eye-popping. It's done to a recording of Judy Garland singing Get Happy, and it's a knockout. It involves a pair of virtual reality goggles that makes anything currently in use seem like Ben Franklin's specs. Fishtown is fresh and surprising and runs at the Bluver Theater at the Drake Apartments in Center City through September 23rd. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.